This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When you go to the shopping mall, you may wonder, why? Why is it this big and confusing? Why can't I find the store I'm trying to get to? Why can't I find where I parked my car? And why does this mall look so much like every other mall? As Paco Underhill writes, somehow the glorious history of commerce has culminated in a sanitized architectural cliché in which you typically find not exquisite treasures and exotic wares, but rather 80 different styles of sneaker or 16 varieties of chocolate chip cookie. Actually, Underhill knows many of the reasons why malls look the way they do, and he reveals some of them in his new book, Call of the Mall. Underhill studies consumer behavior and runs a company which has consulted with large retailers around the world. His previous book was called Why We Buy. Let's begin, as you begin your book, which is in the car, pulling up to the mall and looking for a parking spot. What are the typical strategies for deciding where to park?
I think that varies whether the mall is a familiar place to you or it's not. Most malls have what we call a stranger entrance, which is if you're not a regular patron of the mall, that's the one entrance that you gravitate towards. Often it's the visually closest to wherever you've gotten off the highway. For somebody who knows the mall, there's generally some strategy as to where they're going. Though certainly there is nothing about a mall parking lot that helps you out with the process.
Oh, I'll tell you. And you're almost guaranteed to lose your car when you come out the other end at the end of the day. Do they want you to get lost? I mean, why is it? There's times you can't even find an indicator of where you're parked.
I think one of the ironies about our shopping culture in North America is that merchants and marketers ignore the fact that our shopping experience generally starts and ends in the parking lot. And no matter how great the price or how wonderful the experience is, if the act of getting in the door and getting out the door isn't more pleasant, we may make the choice to take our money and our time somewhere else.
Now, you write in the book, you know, consider before going into the mall, just strolling around the outside, it will be one of the more joyless promenades you have ever made. That is true. Why is that so true?
I think there are a couple of reasons. First is that malls start with a leasing agent, a spreadsheet, and a real estate lawyer, and that the aesthetics of the mall generally comes somewhere down the line. Somebody very accurately described most malls in North America to me as boxes with mouse holes in them.
Mm. So you think the people who create the mall and who are renting to the stores don't really think about the people coming in?
I think most malls here in the U.S. are more than 20 years old, and most of them were thrown up in a frenzy of activity with no real thought as to how long they were supposed to last. I can't imagine more than a handful of malls across the U.S. ever winning landmark status. Can you?
No. Absolutely not. And are you saying that because they're not built to last or because you wouldn't want them to last?
I think it's a combination of the two. I think as we go into the 21st century, there are malls now that are constructed and integrated into a community in a much more thoughtful way, and that they are used as part of a larger, greater plan. And in that sense, they have both architectural as well as socially redeeming values.
Well, why don't we pause here and let me ask you to describe your very favorite mall to us, if you have one.
I wish I could say that I have a favorite mall. There are a few that I tend to gravitate to. Short Hills in New Jersey is a very short drive from my home in Lower Manhattan. I tend to go out once a year and do my obligatory personal shopping. On the other end of the spectrum, there is a mall in Barcelona I like a lot called Diagonal here. It has a real spark to it and is part of a larger redevelopment complex on the south side of the city that's quite impressive. On the other hand, as a 52-year-old man, I love going to malls in Brazil because they are a fashion parade. They're incredibly loud because everyone's wearing fashionable shoes. The clatter of mules and stilettos on the tile floor is absolutely deafening.
It always seems to me that shopping malls have the same stores. Now, the high-end malls and the low-end malls and the medium malls might have a variation, but, you know, all the high-end stores seem to have the low mall same stores, and all the low-end malls seem to have the same stores. Is it ever possible for independent businesses to set up shop in a mall? It doesn't seem to happen very much.
You know, this is a very interesting question, because we existed a curious dichotomy in our merchant/financial culture. Wall Street has increasingly asked the merchant community to grow as fast as they can, not in terms of necessarily just sales, but doors, the number of locations. Part of the problem is once you design a huge fleet, it's tough to fill all of the shelves and make those shelves particularly diverse. If I'm, you know, Walmart or I'm Kmart, the buying engine that I have to fill my shelves can't afford to buy differently for a store in Spokane than they do a store in Birmingham, Alabama. I think at no point in our history now is the opportunity more open for an independent merchant to bring product to the public's face that they're just not finding in other places, because they, as independent merchants, can afford to buy from smaller suppliers than the larger stores can.
But you don't see them in malls, do you?
I think what you're seeing now is the landlords recognizing that they have a dilemma, which is the independent merchant often makes them interesting, but the independent merchant is often unwilling to pay the rent that a major chain is, because an independent merchant often has higher costs.
Right. When it comes to malls, how big is too big? One of the great things about a mall, if you like malls, is that there's a lot of choice, there's a lot of stores. At some point, it gets so big that it's just such a headache. You know, the parking lot's a headache. Getting from one place to another that you might want to go to is a headache. It's kind of exhausting.
One of the scale issues here, I think, deals with the center of gravity. And there is a reason why Mall of America is outside of Minneapolis, that it is a shopping gravity that exists somewhere between Chicago and San Francisco, and therefore is able to generate traffic that comes often from a significant distance. Whereas where you sit in Philadelphia, or I sit here in New York, our choice of shopping venues is almost infinite. One of the issues we face in the year 2004 is that no one is building a shopping mall today to service a brand new market. We are building a shopping mall today to steal somebody else's market. We also recognize that the primary driver of shopping malls, which is adult women, have gone through a profound change in 25 years. 70% of adult women work outside the home. That means that they have the multiple tasks of being often mother, spouse, bread earner, as well as purchasing agent. And that's a very different state than they existed in 30 years ago when most shopping malls were built.
There's so many malls that are dead now, like they've expired. What happens to the dead malls?
The lucky ones get reinvented in some way. Some of them get reinvented in some parts of the country as ethnic malls. They become an Asian mall, or they become a Latino mall. Some of them get lucky when they're bought by a church or some other organization that makes the transformation. The rest of them, Terry, I think are, you know, destined for a bulldozer and a jackhammer.
Yeah, and not landmark status.
And not landmark status.
My guest is Paco Underhill, author of the book Call of the Mall. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Paco Underhill is my guest, and he's an expert on how people shop and why they buy what they buy, where they buy it, and so on. He consults to many shopping malls and stores and banks, and he's the author of the new book, Call of the Mall. Something you say in the book that I thought was really interesting is that, you know, a lot of men really think of themselves as hating the malls, and but for younger men, this is like the generation that grew up thinking of the mall as the place where you get away from the parents. It's the first place they drop you off, where you're on your own, where you meet your friends and just hang out with them. And so a mall is a much more hospitable place for younger men than for older men. That's interesting. I never thought of it that way.
Most of us who are over age 40 recognize that the mall is bogus. We have some childhood connection to Main Street. At age 52, I would not call up one of my buddies and say, meet me at the mall, let's spend the afternoon. But if I'm 19 or 25, much less 13, that's a very acceptable way for two men to spend some time together.
Hmm. Now, what do you call yourself, a retail anthropologist?
No, Terry, that's what the press calls me.
I see, okay.
I call myself a bald, stuttering, middle-aged research wonk.
That's right. You do call yourself that in the book. but you spend so many years studying how shoppers move through stores, how the placement of things helps determine what's purchased. How did you get so interested in that? Because you also confess in your book that you're not a shopper. So why are you even interested in it?
I was originally a poor part-time adjunct instructor in a doctoral program in environmental psychology here in New York City. And on one of the research projects I was working on, I was on the roof of a building in Seattle. It was 60 floors up. There was a stiff wind blowing. The building was sort of rocking in the breeze, particularly up at the top. And I really dislike heights. And as I lashed my cameras at the edge of that building, looking down at the streets below, I realized I had to reinvent myself. And about a week later, I was standing in a bank in New York City getting madder by the moment. And it occurred to me there that the same tools that I'd been using to look at what makes a good street or the dynamics of a public sitting area or how a bus stop works or to compare the design of different types of trash cans in an urban setting, that I probably could take inside a store or a bank and look at what makes a good store or a bank. I'm very proud of the fact that it's now 25 years later, and the firm that I founded, I think last year we executed projects in 27 countries across the globe looking at prototype stores and prototype banks.
You mentioned in your book that you grew up in third world countries because your father was a diplomat, so you were actually out of touch with American popular culture because you weren't growing up with it. Does that connect to your interest in malls and to retail?
I think so here. I think of malls as being the dipstick of our culture, that much of human civilization is wrapped up in the exchange of goods and money. It's what drove us across the Atlantic to the new world. It's what constructed the silk routes. It's what invented the clipper ship. It is one of the places where we can see the evolving nature of the human condition. And, for better or for worse, I think it's evidence of who we are and what we are and where we're going and also where we've been.
Do you believe that there's such a thing as mall exhaustion, and at some point your average shopper will say, I can't take it anymore, I'm getting out of here? And if so, what do you advise your clients about how to prevent that from happening? Because it's their job to keep the consumer there as long as possible.
Well, I think all of us have had mall exhaustion here. And I've had it as much as anyone, perhaps more than anyone, because I've had to spend so much time there. Couple of things. First is having a place to sit. If you're a family, having a quiet place to actually go regroup. There are many new malls being built now as neo-villages where they actually take off the roofs. And when you step out of the store, you get a hit of whatever the weather is and a hit of oxygen and have to look at where the curb is. All of those things are positive. One of the factors that we advise our clients are is recognizing that time comes in three forms: real time, perceived time, and a combination of the two. And that one of the most important things that any merchant or any placemaker can do is have an impact on people's perceived time. That somehow I get the sense that my time is being used well. I know where I am. I'm not getting lost. Or if I'm getting lost, it's because I've let myself get lost deliciously. That honesty with the 21st century consumer, I think, is what governs a successful shopping experience.
Do you think malls are here to stay?
Terry, for you and I, malls will be part of our future. They may not be the same powerhouse that they were in 1985, but yes, malls are part of our future. Let's recognize something, though, is that retail follows housing. There are many of us in the baby boomer generation that are deciding now how we spend the last third of our lives. For some of us, it may mean moving back to a city. For some of us, it's leaving the nest and moving farther out. For some of us, it may be having multiple houses. Whatever those housing choices are, merchants and marketers are going to have to follow us, because between 60 and 70% of all discretionary income in North America is in the hands of people who are 50 and over.
Then how come so much of women's apparel is designed for anorexic teenagers?
I asked that question as well as my significant only, who was a very proud and beautiful size 12.
And do you answer the question?
When a merchant complains that somehow they aren't generating the income, I tell them that they aren't following the money.
Okay. Well, one last question. When you go to a parking lot, can you find your car when you're through? Do you write down, like, the name of the store next to the entrance that you came into?
Well, it's even harder when you have a rental car and all of a sudden it occurs.
You don't even know what your car is.
You can't remember what it is or what color it was. I've had that problem.
Paco Underhill is the author of the new book, Call of the Mall. Coming up, Peter Pan is turning 100, and critic-at-large John Powers is thinking about our youth-obsessed culture. This is Fresh Air.